Our second panel is going to drill down on two of the, I guess you can't drill down on a pillar. I'll have to do a different metaphor here. But we're going to drill down on a couple of the major underpinnings of the what we were calling the pivot until the last panel, and we will stop calling the pivot, the rebalancing of U.S. policy towards the Asia-Pacific region. We have two panelists from outside of Brookings this time. General Gregson, Chip Gregson, is going to talk about U.S. military strategy in the Asia-Pacific region. Again, you have General Gregson's bio. I would just add that Chip was a treasured colleague of mine in the administration in the last couple of years, my counterpart over at the Defense Department in charge of the East Asia region. I think Richard Bush at the end of the last discussion suggested that we finally get Futenma taken care of, and perhaps Chip can describe in his talk today why we haven't been able to get that done in the last 16 years. And then Claude Barfield, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, is going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Claude is one of the real wise men on economic policy in a city with very few wise people, and someone whose approval any administration is looking for on anything they do in the trade and investment area. Chip, why don't you lead us off?
Oh, thank you. Well, no horse is so dead that we can't flog it some more, so I'll begin with discussing the oft-discussed pivot that we began with here. Secretary Clinton, or perhaps one of her staff, provided the most enduring description of our emerging military and security policy in the Western Pacific. Secretary Clinton said we stand at a pivot point as we prepare to withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan, that we have to be smart and systematic about where we invest our time and energy, and that one of the most important tasks of American statecraft over the next decade will therefore be to lock in a substantially increased investment, diplomatic, economic, strategic, and otherwise, in the Asia-Pacific region. Pivot point may not have been the best metaphor. The press, no doubt aware of the president's roundball expertise, immediately shortened this to pivot. In basketball, pivoting to something means pivoting away from something else. But it's hard to see how we get Asia right without some acceptable degree of stability and security in the Middle East, the source of much of Asia's energy. In fact, in both our rhetoric and our actions, we are maintaining a significant presence in the Gulf, both afloat and ashore. Nevertheless, her description of our policy, strategy, and intentions was welcomed in the Asia-Pacific region. This continued a positive trend that began with her earlier statement at the ASEAN Regional Forum that reconfirmed our support for peaceful settlement of many territorial disputes in the region. Later, she reaffirmed that the Senkaku Islands do indeed fall under Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Treaty. Throughout her tenure, she's provided consistent and welcome attention to our allies, particularly Japan, and friends, most recently Burma. In all of this, we can see an unstated but powerful theme of our Asia and the Pacific policy, that of friends first. We have an Asia and Pacific policy covering all aspects of national life, business, commerce, economics, energy, education, environment, as well as traditional security. They are all connected and mutually reinforcing. We can't have a bipolar, security-only U.S.-China policy and strategy. It has to be embedded into our regional and extra-regional policies and strategies. This notion is a bit harder to drive into public opinion and into the bureaucracy than it might appear. As the Soviet Union was collapsing, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs summoned his chairman's study group. This four-person group was three colonels and a Navy captain chosen carefully by each service chief. The chairman had a simple question. What do we do now that we've lost our best enemy? For nearly 50 years of Cold War, the national security structure, Pentagon planning and acquisition processes, and military planning had all developed in response to a reliable and predictable enemy. Suddenly, all of that was no longer relevant. In many ways, we are still looking for a new best enemy. Life was much simpler for our bureaucratic functions when we had a single, well-defined villain right out of central casting. The villain is gone, and China is most definitely not the replacement. The U.S. needs China to be a successful contributor to the international system. At the same time, we need to work with our allies and friends and be there to support their interest, many of these well beyond what are considered as traditional security interests. Asia and the Pacific stretches from the Indian subcontinent to the western shores of the Americas. It spans two oceans increasingly linked by shipping, energy, trade, and strategy. It includes five U.S. treaty allies. It includes sovereign U.S. territory, one island nation in covenant with the United States that is treated like a territory, and three island nations in compacts of free association with the United States. It includes the world's most populous country and the future most populous country. The world's largest and second largest Muslim population within single national boundaries are in this region. It's home to three maritime straits, the Malacca, the Sunda, and the Lombok, that permit the easy passage of well over 1,100 fully laden supertankers per year, most passing into the South China Sea, bringing energy to China, Japan, the Republic of Korea, Taiwan, and others. This body of water is surrounded by China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, Indonesia, Taiwan, and Singapore. Many nations have competing claims to various islands and reefs in the South China Sea, and thus competing claims to fishing grounds, seabed resources, and exclusive economic zones. 50% of the world's seaborne tonnage and one-third of the world's value in trade traverses this sea. If the world has a commercial intersection, this is it. Traditional law, as favored by the United States, calls for freedom of navigation and peaceful settlements of disputes. This is increasingly challenged by China's claim of historical rights to the entire South and East China Seas. The Chinese National Oil Corporation has placed a $20 billion bet that the South China Sea has enough oil resources to be the second Persian Gulf. China finds itself pulled in two divergent directions by continental and maritime interests, but on a truly trans-regional scale. 14 land powers share terrestrial frontiers with China, while six maritime countries together enclose the entire Chinese coastline. Of these 20 neighboring states, six rank among the world's top 10 in population, eight rank among the top 25 in military forces, and four possess nuclear weapons. China has settled 12 of the 14 land border disputes. China no longer has any natural enemies on her borders, but neither does she have any natural friends. The closest friends might be North Korea, Pakistan, and Burma. It's not obvious that provides any advantages. The region as a whole has many built-in stresses that can cause conflict. Some of the more dominant or powerful include demographics, energy, food and agriculture, and fresh water. All are interrelated as numbers of people and their movement affect food security, water availability and purity, as well as energy production and use. Often these goals conflict. For example, the use of hydropower to produce energy often reduces the availability of agricultural land and fresh water. The world will add nearly 60 million people per year, reaching over 8 billion by the 2030s. Most growth will be in developing countries. The United States alone among developed countries is expected to add 50 million people. Europe, Japan, Russia, and Korea will join those in absolute population decline. China will add some 170 million, but the population will be aging and predominantly male. India, in contrast, will add 320 million people, becoming the world's most populous nation before 2030. Aging and declining populations will stress support systems. Welfare systems in developed countries are based on assumptions of moderate economic and population growth. Remittance flows are essential parts of the economies of many states. In 2007, the top three recipients of immigrant remittances were India, Mexico, and China. Disruption or alteration of these flows due to failing governments, war, pestilence, natural disaster, or other phenomenon can affect peace and stability. When economic conditions collapse in a region or remittance flows are altered, uncontrolled population movements result. India will continue to grow, risking tension between the rich and the poor, as well as among Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists. The Maoists in much of eastern India are India's most important security challenge, by their definition. Rapid development in China, India, and other countries creates a relentless drive to assure adequate and secure supplies of fuel to sustain growth, maintain satisfaction, and prevent internal strife. Multiple disputes over access to seabed resources in the South China Sea regularly fill the news. Massive additional production and refining capacity is needed to avert resource shortages as world population grows. Japan is currently coping with energy shortage caused by a natural disaster, illustrating the fragility of energy infrastructure. Every freshwater system on the east, southeast, and South Asian littoral is under heavy pressure from pollution. The search for affordable energy invites upstream countries to build hydroelectric dams on rivers coming out of their mountains. Ungoverned, this can cause devastation to downstream nations and cultures dependent on nutrients to sustain their aquaculture-dependent lifestyles. Needless to say, Asia has a poor record of collegial dispute settlement. Ocean fish stocks are already under severe pressure from overfishing and illegal fishing. Without some agreement, some code of conduct on fishing and effective enforcement means, many species and nations are in danger. Recently, such disputes caused the death of a Korean Coast Guardsman at the hand of a Chinese fisherman. It's been mentioned many times today about the impact of and the purpose of the intended rotation of Marines to Northern Australia. It must be important because China seems to feel that 2,500 Marines, 3,600 miles from Beijing, are a dagger pointed right at their heart. Don't tell the Marines, they'll be even more arrogant than they are now. A few principles should be stated before we talk about this. We deploy forces overseas to operate in support of the policy and strategy of the United States. We do this with the active cooperation and support of our allies and friends. Military and naval bases overseas are very useful things. They make a profound political statement long before they make a military statement. Any presence of foreign forces in another country requires a compromise of various principles of sovereignty on the part of both countries involved. Any such presence is a strong validation, at some cost, of a shared commitment to common security goals. Bases are also a very useful and cost-effective means to develop, train, and maintain forces. Bases can also support alliance training and development. Bases also provide valuable deployment platforms and support for forces operating throughout the region. Whether one fights from these bases in conflict or from other locations is a different question driven by a number of factors. Our forces overseas have an important deterrent role, but if that was all they did, it would be a very expensive and unprofitable undertaking. The role of our forward deployed forces is far broader and more constructive than simply waiting for someone to turn the master arming switch on. Broad, active, widely distributed presence throughout the theater dampens sources of instability, deters conflict, gives substance to U.S. security commitments, and ensures continuing American access to the region. The presence and the efforts of our forces help shape the regional geopolitical climate, and they remain immediately available if needed. Our bases in Asia and the Pacific are concentrated in Alaska, Hawaii, Korea, and Japan. Guam, after a long period of decline following Vietnam, is again growing. These bases generally are the type that supports our personnel on long tours with families. As a result, they have schools, commissaries, exchanges, movie theaters, hospitals, dental clinics, recreational facilities, and so on. Our concentration in Japan and Korea reflects the enduring and urgent threat of North Korea, our historic obligation to Taiwan, and our Cold War history. Secretary Gates introduced the concept of a widely distributed, operationally resilient, politically sustainable presence for our forces. This signals recognition of the importance of Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean area. It points to an expansion of the geographic distribution of our forces and the geographic reach and distribution of our alliances. In all the rhetoric and discussion of our alliance transformation realignment agreement with Japan, very few observers note the requirement for the U.S. to provide for the continuous presence of Japanese forces and their training in Guam. This is an expansion of the alliance to Guam and a major strategic step forward to rapidly create increased efficiency and effectiveness of our alliance forces when we are operating together in high-intensity modern operations. It also calls for a more lean, agile, and expeditionary posture. Expeditionary in this sense means self-sustaining, stepping lightly on the local infrastructure, and making do with things as you find them. It means not building a little America inside a fence line. It signals an increased emphasis on robust, continuous, bi- and multinational training accomplished through expansion of U.S. and Australian synthetic training environments. These systems, already in place, permit combinations of live, virtual, and constructive forces arrayed in an interactive, hyper-realistic simulation system that replicates faithfully the uncertainty, friction, fog, and stress of high-intensity air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace combat for commanders and their staffs. The Marine presence in Australia is, along with Guam, a big step to these goals. It is a training presence, not a base. It will be deployable, combat-capable combined arms air-ground logistic force. Forces there will be expeditionary, self-sustaining, and self-contained. Our mission will be to work and train with forces from Australia and in the future Japan and other friends and allies. They will be supported by prepositioned ships, amphibious ships, joint high-speed vessel, and high-speed vessel mobility, as well as organic aircraft, including F-A-18, F-35B in the future, the MV-22, the KC-130, and others. Combined deployments with Australian and eventually other forces are possible. In January 2012, the Defense Department published the Priorities for 21st Century Defense for U.S. Security and Policy in the region. In summary, what was published in that document will make things more difficult. We're headed for a fleet of 246 ships, significantly short of the 346 called for by the Bipartisan Quadrennial Defense Review Independent Panel. This is important because no matter how capable the ship, it can only be in one place at one time. And power projection that stays is all about ships. Already we hear from friends in Asia that they fear this will be like the last force reduction episode in the late 1990s. In their memory, we reduced our presence in Asia then and called it an increase in capabilities based because individual weapons systems were better. Even the January 2012 document calls for preserving readiness over force structure, smaller but better, in other words. The document also talks about rebalance toward Asia Pacific and the Middle East, calling for a renewed emphasis on air and naval forces while sustaining ground presence. Along with calls for rebalancing is the statement that we will no longer size ground forces for long-term stability operations. The number of ships will be reduced while retiring others early, and tactical fighter squadrons will also be reduced. There's a stated bias toward the maritime environment, an emphasis on self and rapidly deployable forces and power projection. The public reaction to all this has shortened all of it to reducing personnel to invest in technology. What this means to the region depends on how we play this. Rhetorically, we always extol the virtues of working with allies and friends. Now is the time to really increase our combined training and deployments in response to both policy and budgetary imperatives. Some suggestions, and I'll close with this. Distribute forces in a constant pattern of training and exercises. Train in the Southwest Pacific zone, vice an exclusive focus around a small number of large permanent bases in Japan and Korea and with our other allies. Counter growing precision interdiction threats with a constantly changing array of locations throughout East, Southeast, and South Asia. Expand the deployment pattern into the Ryukyu Archipelago and into the Indian Ocean. build on existing relationships with the Maldives, Seychelles, and Comoros, provide renewable energy systems in return for training access in smaller countries, exploit oceanic vice land-based presence, and leverage islands and atolls along the key energy routes. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's my pleasure to come and talk about the TPP. I've spent a lot of time on it over the last couple of years. I'd actually like to do three things in my time, and that is take a look at the TPP in terms of large – or trade policy, actually, and the TPP specifically in terms of larger U.S. diplomatic and security goals. Second, talk a little bit about the options in East Asia for regional development. And then third, come back to some specifics about the TPP. I just assume that this audience might know a lot about the TPP now, but Ken tells me that he doesn't think that people do, so I'll try to spend a little more time on some of the pieces of it. I'm not going to debate the pivot. I'm going to assume it and go back to the president's trip in November. I think this had been foreshadowed by other things that the administration had said, but I don't know whether Richard Bush is still here, but my reading and trying to read at least the English language press and the reaction to the president's trip in November was that the TPP became a kind of symbol of United States leadership. So as a result, and maybe this was going to be true inevitably, as a result, it assumed an importance, I think, far beyond just another trade agreement, even a regional trade agreement. It is a kind of symbol, it seems to me, or one important symbol to Asians of the United States' ability to pivot and be a leader in terms of the economic architecture in Asia. I would argue some of my friends who are trade economists get very nervous about this. They're not very happy with diplomatic or security intrusions on trade policy. They think it pollutes it. I do not. I would argue that not only in Asia but in other areas, U.S. trade policy has always been intertwined, and this has been particularly, I think, true in Asia for the last two decades, with diplomatic and security issues. I think, and I would go back, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, but I've written a paper, by the way, on what I would argue is the continuity of U.S. economic policy in Asia, even though there have been disruptions. You can see it on the AEI website. But I would go right back to Jim Baker's point in 1991 that the United States was not going to allow a line to be drawn down the middle of the Pacific with us on the one side of it and the Asian nations on the other. When you see what he wrote about that later, he had not just economic considerations, even though there was no China at least looming at the time or no obvious security, but he also was looking at security and diplomatic issues. And I would say that this is carried forward. The Clinton administration had the kind of unipolar moment, so for them I remember that national security was really wrapped up in economic security, but even there when you take NAFTA, you take APEC, the thought was that we were pushing or propelling U.S. ideals about democracy, about democratic institutions, so there was always a mix. I'm coming forward very quickly here, and I think if you want to look at a very detailed approach to trade policy through the prism of diplomacy and security, you would look at the Bush administration. The Bush administration tied its priorities in terms of bilateral and regional agreements directly to larger U.S. security and diplomatic issues. And specifically, Zelik would say again and again, we are going to go for people who would support us. One can agree or disagree with that administration's particular foreign policy, but it was a specific tie. I would also argue that and let me finish that point up to the Obama administration. I would argue we've got people here who were in the administration, but in the Obama administration you really didn't have, and they were not really very much interested because of a divided party, a trade policy, almost through the first year. And the things, I think, that impelled the Obama White House to move in the direction of the TPP and the Korea agreement, among others, was what was happening in East Asia, not in terms of economics, but in terms of diplomacy and in terms of security. It was very hard to make the case, as the administration was making throughout 2009, that we were back in Asia, that we were all in. If you're going to walk away from the Korea agreement, or you weren't going to pick up on the TPP. So I think there was an intertwining all throughout, even with the Obama administration. The other point to note, looking back over all these administrations, is that I think inevitably when you get away from multilateral trade negotiations where theoretically everybody is at the table, and that's all you're dealing with is trade, you inevitably are going to introduce other issues. You know, whether it's the reason we go for with the Colombia FTA or even with Central America, there is economics, but it's not just economics. There are other things that are part of the formula. Having said that, in terms of the TPP, it is an important, I think, symbol of U.S. leadership. But the other thing I have to keep coming back to, and that is, it is that, but as far as the Congress is concerned and interest groups, it is an economic trade agreement. And the dynamics of a trade agreement are very different from the dynamics of other diplomatic or security issues. It's not just in terms of institutions, the State Department, the Defense Department, USTR on the other hand. But looking, and I'll come back to this in terms of where we are and what is likely to happen, the U.S. business community, U.S. interest groups are certainly interested in the United States doing well in Asia, that we take a leadership role. But they're also interested in more mundane things. As Tip O'Neill said, you know, all politics, and certainly that's true in trade, all trade politics is local. They're interested in what's happening in textiles and what's happening in steel and what's happening in services and what's happening in other things. So there is a dynamic that is pushing to get as much as possible and possibly even not to compromise. Moving on from that, let me talk about the alternatives in Asia. As the Obama administration picked up the TPP negotiations or moved forward them. And that is, when the Obama administration came to office, even though you'd had this dart thrown forward with the TPP negotiations, there were a number of options that had developed over the last decade in Asia. And most specifically, and this goes back actually to James Baker's statement, which was a reaction to Malaysia's putting forward the idea of an East Asian Economic Caucus that would exclude the United States. In the years after 2000-2001, there was an alternate vision that went with or began to compete with, and actually I would say by 2006 or 2007, seemed to be more dominant than the Trans-Pacific East Asian vision that goes back to Secretary Baker, but then through the Clinton administration and APEC. And that was an intra-East Asian vision, which is embodied in the ASEAN Plus 3, which had been pushed, was being pushed very strongly, still is, by the Chinese. It envisioned an East Asia that was really self-contained, as it were, in terms of economic institutions, not in terms of trade or in terms of investment, but just in terms of economic institutions. And while the Bush administration's attention was in other directions and wasn't paying much attention to what was happening, I think, in terms of Asian trade until 2006 or 2007, you see the other larger East Asian nations squirm and twist. Japan is the key example, in my view. I remember in 2005, 2006, the Japanese would say, well, you know, we don't see APEC going anywhere, and we're scared to death of what's going to be happening, actually, quietly, they were saying, with an ASEAN plus three, which the Chinese would dominate. And therefore, you got these versions of so-called ASEAN plus six, where the Japanese tried to pull in others, New Zealand, Australia, and India. So there was this kind of clux and mix of potential regional institutions. And let me make one final point about the ASEAN plus three. What quietly happened in the years from 2001 through 2008 or 9 was that the ASEAN plus three began to duplicate in many respects, in fact, almost all respects, the activities of APEC. It's not just a trade agreement any longer. You had energy ministers meeting. You had environmental ministers meeting, tourism ministers meeting. In other words, there was and still is, by the way, a separate vision that is all staffed out, if you will. It's all the pieces are all there. So at the time that the Obama administration came in, the Asians did have and still do have, and I'll come back to this, an alternative to the TPP and building. The TPP, by the way, is meant to build upon the APEC, which is a trans-Pacific vision. For a long time, though, going back to Japanese, I take the Japanese diplomats as a symbol here. they would argue, well, you know, we'll come back to APEC, to a free trade of the Pacific agreement, which was put forward in 2006. But let's build to, we'll go to the ASEAN plus three, and then we'll get the Japan, Korea, and China to add on to that. All of these countries, by the way, had agreements with ASEAN. And then we'll come back to the United States then. I mean, my argument was that that will not work very well in terms of the U.S. Congress because of discrimination and also because of the symbol. But that was, certainly was, and I think still is, a possibility. Now, let me turn for the next few minutes to the TPP itself. And here I'm not going to go over into a lot of detail except about some things, a few things that are important, I think, for our discussion today. The first thing, if you want to really look at the and I should have amended this by saying, I don't know what's in the TPP. Nobody in this room does, because we haven't seen any text. And what I'm going by is what people who write about this in Washington and other places is there have been a lot of leaks. You talk to trade staff. You talk to diplomatic staff. There's a fair amount of knowledge you know, but I don't. What I'm saying is not certainly verifiable in terms of anything that we've seen. But from what we know, I would say that when you look at what's going to emerge, the main template to look at, I would argue, is the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. And what you're going to find in the TPP, we talk about WTO plus. What you will find in the TPP is CORUS, or the U.S.-Korea Agreement, plus in some areas. They are putting together a standard free trade agreement with 25 or I forget how many chapters now, 25 to 30 chapters. It has the normal things about market access, about services, about investment, about sanitary and food safety issues, all those sorts of things. I'm going to pass that by and talk just about one area that has had a lot of attention and the United States keeps coming back to a lot, and that is you will hear that the major characteristics of the TPP is that it is a 21st century agreement. You hear it endlessly. And what the hell do people mean by that? It's sometimes hard to tell. But there are some things I think we can glean, to be fair to the United States. And I would say that the Australians and New Zealanders is the most developed countries among the nine nations that constitute the TPP today, pretty much back the United States in the substance here. Where they get nervous is the United States' highly legalistic approach to all these things. But what are we talking about when we're talking about a 21st century agreement? The most important thing to note is that, by and large, it means policies that are inside the border. It's not tariffs or things on the border itself. And this did not just begin with this. Obviously, we've had the multilateral agreements with the Uruguayan, which went inside the border. But what the United States and others are pushing here is regulatory reform, in effect. Regulatory coherence is a big term that is used. It also means a great deal of detail about due process and regulations, of notice, of the ability to protest, the ability to appeal a decision. So it's a whole klux of regulatory issues. In addition, in the last 6 months, and here, while the administration argues vehemently that this is not aimed at China, certainly China is what they're looking over their shoulder at, and that is a set of rules for state-owned enterprises. This is actually competition policy for state monopolies or state-influenced corporations, and that has been a key. It is a major pressure point for the U.S. business community, and that has become quite important. There are other parts of the what could be counted a 21st century agreement in terms of regulatory policy. And in terms of it relates to customs areas, to trade facilitation, the ability to move goods back and forth, the ability to key into the multiple supply chains which are characteristic of the Asian region. And here, let me just add a note of caution. The United States, and again, I want to emphasize, I do not know exactly what is in the agreement. But the United States, in pushing the 21st century policies, has thus far, at least as far as we can tell, been quite reticent about some what you might call 18th or 19th century mercantilist policies on its own. And that is, the kinds of reforms that one would look to make seamless the supply chains are the kinds of things, not just on the border. Yes, tariffs are important, but we don't have many. You don't have high tariffs. You don't even have many low tariffs, actually, in East Asia for the goods that are important. But also things that would disrupt the flow, such as anti-dumping or countervailing duties, or buy America, or buy China, or buy Japan. Here, and rules of origin are rules, for those of you who are not part of the trade mafia, that are rules to stop somebody, if you have a bilateral agreement, from coming in through the back door through your trading partner or through your multiple trading partners. The United States seems to have been quite reticent in holding on to the 18th or 19th century mercantilist policies, while it is pushing the others in the direction of something, some so-called 20th century in terms of regulatory reform. That is one of the tensions, I think, that we'll see play out in the next months. A lot of this has been discussed over the last year. I mean, there have been 10 negotiating sessions since early 2010. But there are still no legal texts. And we'll just have to see how this works out. A couple of other final points. One is the question of, in many of these areas, whether you take anti-dumping or you take rules of origin, you take agriculture, the situation, this is not unique with the United States, where the United States is having to negotiate with its trading partners who may have different views. The New Zealanders clearly have a different view about intellectual property than the United States. But it also does not have full support back here. There's disagreement among the administration's constituencies and then other constituencies about what we're going to do in agriculture, what we would do with anti-dumping, what we would do with rules of origin. And so it is a dicey negotiation in all aspects. The other thing that I should note before talking about the clearing up with where we're going to go in the next six to 12 months, is that the other thing that makes it very interesting and unique is this has not been tried before, actually, in terms of putting together an agreement and negotiating while you have new countries potentially coming in. This agreement started with four countries, but then you had another three or four, five, actually, in the first year, so that wasn't a problem. But we now have the situation where you've got Japan, Mexico, Canada, and others potentially wanting to come in. And I would say that what has happened since November is that we have seen a large increase in the activity, particularly in Canada and Mexico and also in Japan. I think I'm going to leave to the discussion what may happen with Japan because it's more complicated. But clearly the Canadians, the Mexicans are moving fairly quickly. The dilemma for the negotiators is how and when do we pick these nations up? We've made some decisions. Do we have to go back? On the other hand, and I should make this point finally to go back to my point about diplomacy and the security issue, this is a two-way street. The fact is that the TPP is pretty small potatoes in economic terms as it stands. It's only when you get Korea, Japan, Mexico, and Canada that you really begin to get the weight so that this is an important regional agreement. And so here is where I think the tension will be within the administration, would be within any administration. How do we bring and it goes also beyond, by the way, USTR. USTR has a mission about trade negotiations. But here's where I would argue that I hope that Secretary Clinton comes very much more involved in this and others beyond just the trade community in the next 6 to 9 months. but it's going to be, a dicey situation. Finally, I don't think the president put forward finishing this up by December of 2012 of this year. I don't think that's possible. I don't think that they will even get full text during the summer, or at least through the summer. In order to get something through this year, you'd have to finish pretty much right now, because you'd have to go to the Congress. You have to have the legal text done for everyone. It's quite complicated. So I think that the truth is that this negotiation is going to go well into 2013, where we don't know what the political situation is. But to go back to my point about the other nations, My guess is that it could very well be that the Canadians and possibly the Mexicans could get themselves could get their houses in order. The Koreans could come in tomorrow if they chose to do so. And this gets me to the final point, the final point. and that is, clearly the Chinese since November have stepped up their pressure on Korea and Japan to enter into either bilateral agreements or a trilateral agreement. My suspicion is that the Japanese will not go in this direction, though I will defer to other Japanese scholars here, for a variety of political and economic reasons. But the Koreans may be in a somewhat different situation, and they very well could go forward, at least go forward with a bilateral negotiation, even though they wouldn't finish it. From the U.S. perspective, I would argue that we should not, in any sense, express disagreement here or try to stop them. I think the key for us to be to tell the Koreans that, okay, we're happy to have you go forward with this if you think this is in your economic interest, but we also want you to go forward with entering in some fairly quickly the TPP negotiations. Thank you very much.
Okay, I thought that was terrific. Let me just open it up with one question to Claude and one question to Chip. Claude, I was going to ask you, is precisely what you got into towards the end of your discussion there, but let me expand on it a little bit. When I was at the White House, I saw studies on the potential economic benefits of TPP versus the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And the studies I saw show that in terms of job creation, exports, that Korea agreement was orders of magnitude more important than TPP as it stood with those particular players. And as you said, right now it's sort of economically small potatoes. As you think about the negotiating strategy, leaving aside for a moment the political considerations, do you think it's, in terms of getting the big actors into the agreement, whether it's Korea, Mexico, Canada, Japan, on the kinds of terms that we want, do you think it's better to try to negotiate with the current partners we've got, try to get the best agreement we can with this group with whom presumably we have somewhat more leverage, get the best kind of agreement we can, and then say to the others, okay, come on in on negotiated terms? Or do you think that the chances of ultimately producing an economically significant agreement call for bringing in some of the other major players during the negotiation? That's my question for you, Claude, opening question then. And for Chip, when we were in the administration, you know, we faced issues of U.S. forces in Japan, U.S. forces in Korea. I'd like you to sort of look ahead 5 years, 10 years, which I realize is impossible, but try. Do you see pressures in Japan, in Korea, and budgetary pressures, other pressures in the U.S. that are likely to change our force deployments in those countries? Or do you think that they are on a fairly stable long-term basis at current levels?
Well, I think you have to take it almost by country. And I don't think there's an either-or here. I understand, and I may have seemed in hurrying not sympathetic to the worry of the United States that we'll end up like the WTO and the Doha round. You get these, you say, okay, you guys can all come in, and then you've got to go back and reinvent the wheel, and with the Japan you might have really as extended negotiation. On the other hand, I think, as I say, it is a two-way street. And I think you then have to approach them, it seems to me, individually. It seems to me, as I say, there's nothing that would stop Korea tomorrow if they had made the political will. I think the Canadians also are closer. I know that there are dairy interests in the United States, and there are other things about their wheat, et cetera, et cetera. But the Canadians have an pretty open economy. And so I think the key with all of them is this, from my perspective. They must, at whatever time this has to be done by consensus with the others, agree to have them join the negotiations. They must agree at least that everything is on the table. You cannot let the Japanese exclude this or that part, or the Canadians in terms of the wheat board. What I think where it's getting difficult is that you've got, and by the way, this administration will be no different from the Bush administration or other administrations, and they have not been stepped up to the mat on this as much. You've got a number of interest groups and business groups who want pre-negotiation. They want to have something set down before you even get started in the negotiation. And I think that you're just not going to be able to sell. I understand the administration's, this administration or any administration's difficulty, but I think the other thing that they have to keep in mind is that this is still small potatoes, and you've got to have these guys in there if it's going to be anything mm-hmm. important, even before you get to the diplomatic and security. And there is an alternative for them. They could go the intra-Asian route. The Chinese would be happy to sign agreements with all three of them.
Oh, Chip.
There's a saying that victory is the solvent of alliances, that once the original purpose of the alliance is achieved, then the alliance either has to radically adapt or the alliance goes away because the purpose of it has gone away. Korea and Japan present two very interesting and different situations. Our alliance with Korea started essentially in 1950 when we rushed over there after leaving Asia that time, which was the last time. Right after the end of World War II. And for the long period of time, Korea was under a military dictatorship during a long part of our alliance in the last century. After they achieved a democratic government, the nature of their armed forces changed considerably, and the sway that the military held over governance in the country on things both large and small went away very rapidly. Also, the Combined Forces Command developed, and there was a continuous interaction between the Korean forces and the American forces. And the Korean forces now, from top to bottom, are in my estimation, very, very good. They can manage sophisticated tactics and operations as well as we can. And it's been very much a combined development. Our bases there were, and to some extent still remain, a legacy of where we stopped when the shooting stopped in the Korean War. We've done a pretty fair job in getting rid of a lot of the easy bases that were easy to get rid of and consolidate into one place. We're in a difficult operation now to close the remaining places, Yongsan, right in the middle of Seoul, which has, of course, grown considerably since it originally arrived there, and consolidate down. And we're still working on the modalities of how forces are going to be commanded there in recognition that the Koreans have achieved such great capability. The threat still remains. North Korea still has about 80% of its armed forces positioned along the DMZ, and this audience needs no reminder of the rest of the things going on. Japan is different, with a completely different relationship with the self-defense forces than most nations have with their armed forces. Progress and development has been somewhat affected by that, but the Cold War ended when it did. And in rapid form, we had the defense guidelines in the late 1990s, the acquisition and cross-servicing agreement. We've had the most recent National Defense Program guidelines, which are rather breathtaking by Japanese standards on their forward-looking. And interestingly, in recent years, Japanese and Americans have both deployed forces to different operations at different times, the Japanese to Cambodia with the UN, to the Golan Heights and other places. Then we both deployed to the same place at different times, East Timor. We went in, we left. Then the Japanese came down with an engineering battalion and were there, and then they left. And then most recently, the deployment to Iraq, not most recently, but a recent deployment to Iraq. And then now the Japanese have the P-3 detachment flying out of Djibouti, engaged in a multinational counter-piracy patrols. Where we go from here depends on how well we adapt to things and how well we adapt to common purposes. It'll change, and it should change as the Japanese develop, and as conditions change, then the Japanese, the disposition of the Japanese and the U.S. forces should change. One of the reasons I leaned a bit on the potential that Guam and other surrounding islands offer, and the Australian situation offers, is that Japanese already train in the United States, but it's a very expensive proposition from there. If you've ever made the flight to, from Tokyo to San Francisco, you know what I mean. It's difficult to get forces here. They usually go to Yakima, Washington, or to Camp Pendleton in California. They have Japanese students in our service schools. Establishing a training capability in and around Guam, along with whatever else happens with the development of Guam in that area, would be a great boon to bilateral training of the U.S. and Japanese forces, and one more adaptation along the way.
Questions?
Thanks. I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council and the Malaysia America Society. Question for Claude about the TPP. If Canada and Mexico enter the negotiations, how will this affect NAFTA? And do the governments of Canada and Mexico regard this as potentially a way to change certain important aspects of NAFTA?
I think inevitably it will affect NAFTA. One of the things I didn't go into, skipping across all the material, was that this this is not new. Another thing that makes this negotiation unique is that you've got nations that already have bilateral agreement in the existing nine that have bilateral agreements with each other: United States, Singapore, the United States, Australia, and then we don't have bilateral agreements with others. And that's, I'm not going to go through all the others who do and do not, but you've got the key, and this would affect the Canada and Mexico. The tension is how much do you create de novo a new agreement, particularly for market access. Our trading partners, New Zealand and Australia, my understanding is, pushing very hard for this to be a new agreement. The United States, because it has offensive interests in some areas, such as intellectual property, and defensive interests in rules of origin, has resisted that. I don't know where that stands. This would be writ large if Canada and Mexico came in. But as they now have launched delegations all around to look, you know, to talk with the various partners in the TPP, they must know that. I don't know how, it's too soon to know how they would, they themselves want to deal with it, or the United States wants to deal with it.
Over here on the left.
My name is Greg Colella. I'm a student at Princeton, and I have a question for General Gregson. How can the U.S. manage and mitigate negative Chinese perceptions of force redistribution and deployment changes if they get paranoid about 2,500 Marines in Australia? What are going to be the repercussions for joint training operations in the South China Sea and things like that?
Well, transparency is required. We try and be as candid as we can be about these things, and it doesn't have to be a zero-sum situation. We have Chinese participation in the counter-piracy operations in the Western Indian Ocean, and China's contributing in that way to the global good in consonance with her position as a great power. I don't see the things the same as creating a training complex in well east of the Philippines, in Guam, et cetera, as the same as trying to militarize things in the South China Sea. I don't know that that's in the cards, and I don't know that that's being planned.
The only thing I would add is I would not assume on the basis of, an editorial in the Global Times that the PLA or senior Chinese leadership takes as paranoid or hysterical a view as your question implied, and I understand where you're coming from. My sense is that there is a more realistic view within the PLA high command and in the party about what this Australia deployment means.
Ken Lieberthal, Brookings. Cloud, the question is a very simple one. Why isn't South Korea seeking to join the TPP?
They're exhausted. They went through a huge negotiation with the EU, and then they turned and went through a huge negotiation with us, and then it got extended, and they're just still sort of wiping their brows and saying, God, thank God it's over. Now, I think I say that, but I'm sure they are thinking about this. And they already are having to make. If you talk to Korean scholars, I haven't talked to anyone in the government since this is all when we've all finished, is that they know there's a kind of balancing act that they're going to have to go through. I remember reading somewhere, and I shouldn't say this because this is just was a rumor, that the Chinese had already given indications they would not be happy if Korea moved directly to the TPP, but I don't know that that is. But at any rate, if they haven't, it's one of those things that they're balancing, I think.
All right, we'll give Nelson a second shot here, only because he's Chris Nelson.
This is, I can't help it myself, two fingers. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. I think a larger reason right now is that they're in election season on steroids, with a National Assembly election coming up in the middle of April. And the former ruling party, the Liberal Democrats, have made a point of campaigning against CORUS for last year, and they've promised to try to rescind as much of it as they can if they get in. So just for that alone, plus exhaustion, that would seem to be unlikely for now, despite how much we would like to have them.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. I think that the close comments about all politics being local, I think all trade politics in Korea, especially in Korea, is local. Over there.
Well, that's happened in Japan. My understanding is the LDP has come out against, even though we had a top Japanese cabinet member at AEI a couple of weeks ago, and he is in dissent from that. But they are playing politics. Their parties are playing politics with it, just as it's happening in Korea. The TPP, I'm talking about. Excuse me.
Thank you. Mr. Chip, yes,
I identify yourself and your...
My name's Dan Gibbons with Georgetown University. I was very interested in your comments vis-a-vis the lack of really a sort of a collaborative dispute process in Asia. Encouraged by the administration's military efforts vis-a-vis such things as piracy. I've heard it cited the natural disaster response kinds of things. I wonder if you have a sense of where the administration is going with this kind of movement towards this region in those kinds of areas, given the fact of not a large collaborative kind of approach that kind of approach that they have normatively or culturally or whatever.
Right. There's not the collaborative thing like, for example, there's no NATO equivalent, nor is there going to be a NATO equivalent. But there are, I perhaps overstated it a little bit, there are other dispute resolution forums emerging, You mentioned disaster relief. I'm pretty sure the United States still strongly supports ASEAN's efforts to cobble together a voluntary effort for many nations to respond to various natural disasters. And that's a common approach to what can be a common problem, and that leads to other dispute resolution things. The I hit on the fisheries thing. I think that's not just because there's an environmental consideration here with overfishing certain species, but because with all the countries that depend on nutrients from the sea and catching fish and the growth of populations that we expect to see and the continuing pollution of the oceans in many ways, which further damages the aquaculture and the support for marine life, this is something we need to figure out how to solve. And there may be efforts afoot to do this. I know that the Pacific Fleet has helped to participate in various surveillance and apprehension of illegal fishermen, but that's small potatoes. We need a serious effort to resolve this, and to as I said, there may be efforts underway, but I haven't seen them. And
the only thing I would add is the notion of peaceful resolution of disputes very much underlay what Secretary Clinton did in Hanoi at the ASEAN Regional Forum in July of 2010. She was trying to revive a longstanding PRC-ASEAN dialogue on resolution of, on articulation of a code of conduct for activity in the South China Sea, as well as for peaceful resolution of disputes. And since then, the administration has continued to give voice to that notion in ARF meetings at the East Asia Summit. The position has evolved a little bit in terms of what Secretary Clinton has to say about putting forward the importance of putting forward claims based on the law of the sea. But what has not happened, and I think cannot happen, is a specific U.S. role, or U.S., as you said at the end, some articulation of some normative process that we would take the lead on. I think there's an assumption that it would be dead on arrival with the states of the region, particularly with the Chinese. So I think the notion is to try to give a moral force and international support and pressure for a process that the Chinese and the ASEANs have already said that they're committed to, and to kind of shine the spotlight on it to move it forward. Okay, over here in the second row.
Hi, Mark Mannion with the Congressional Research Service. Chip, a question for you. Can you talk in a little bit more detail about the importance of the relocation to Guam and to this whole emphasis on diversification and making more flexible the U.S. Troop presence in Asia? Of course, it's tied to the FATEMA issue, which is problematic. It's tied to Congress, which has zeroed out funding for a lot of the construction there. So I guess to put the question in a different way is, if Guam doesn't happen, what does that mean for these goals of making more diversified and flexible U.S. presence in Asia?
Well, the initials for the Futenma Replacement Facility, of course, are FRF, and the Japanese say that there's another set of initials, FIF, Futenma is forever, and they don't want that either. This has got a long history. It started in 1991, got renewed life in 1995. In 1996, we had the Special Action Committee on Okinawa, which had some 43 different initiatives. The easy ones were accomplished. The fatal flaw in the SACO agreement to getting things done, including moving Futenma, was that the SACO agreement fell victim to the usual bureaucratic practice that getting the agreement is the hardest thing, and we'll leave implementation to somebody else, toss it over your shoulder. Second thing, it was limited to Okinawa. And third, there were no forcing functions. And two or three times it's been mentioned that all politics is local. I can tell you that living in Okinawa for 3 years, you'd have two jurisdictions in Okinawa that disagreed on something and everything froze. You couldn't go forward. You couldn't go backwards. So the agreements of 2005, 2006, and 2010 were intended to solve a problem of a certain size by making it bigger, add more initiatives to it. 19 initiatives, 18 are accomplished or on their way to being accomplished. The one that's not, of course, is the one that's left. And it's pretty much a dual action thing. Nobody moves to Guam unless we get the Futenma replacement facility. The 895 hectares that are promised to be returned with the closure of five bases out of the, in the most crowded part of Okinawa, don't go back to Japan until we get the Futenma replacement facility. Lost, long lost in this. This isn't a recent thing. This is a bipartisan effort, and at least two administrations, if not three. We allowed local politics, both in Guam and in Okinawa, to assume control of the conversation. And nobody was making the strategic case that this is an adaptation of the alliance. It's an expansion. It's an enhancement to training for both the U.S. and the Japanese. It's a diversification, a distribution of forces, and those things. We need to be able to make that case to be successful with this. There's renewed interest that it's going to be that success is possible. If it all fails, this can't be good for the alliance. Number one, you don't solve a problem on Okinawa. The forces remain in the most crowded southern one-third of Okinawa. They don't get the land back that can lead to the educational and business development of Okinawa. And one of the issues here that's not often mentioned is Okinawa is 47th out of 47 prefectures in Japan in virtually every major economic and educational statistic. And that needs to be fixed. For one thing, Okinawa is the only prefecture in Japan with a growing population. If they want to recover from the economic difficulties, Okinawa needs to be a contributor, not a cost center, as I think somebody mentioned this morning. Earlier today. It has the potential to be a blow to the alliance. Whether it's a fatal one or not, I don't know. That would be totally conjecture, but it would not be good. Also not good would be, in summation, we forego a major initiative to contribute to the development of a prefecture that needs development. And we forego a major, I think, strategic redefinition of alliance roles and functions. And I think it would be a very bad outcome.
So the cost to... So you're saying if Guam doesn't get built up...
Guam's going to build up in some ways. We've added submarines to the naval base there. 13th Air Force and Anderson Air Force Base used to be, frankly, pretty much empty, except for two or three aircraft. Now there's aircraft there all the time. 13th Air Force has built up their stocks there. The Army is going to be moving there. The thing that gets lost in this is that we won't be moving half of the forces from Okinawa, basically half of the Marines anyway, down to Guam, which would enhance the reach for the United States and for the alliance into areas that are increasingly important to us, Southeast Asia and South Asia.
I think this will be the last question. The young woman in the third row.
Thank you, Shu Lin from Doorway Times. 2 weeks ago, our attention was on a series of actions that the United States has taken economically and militarily, which was interpreted as containing China. But last week, President Obama started to blame China on economic issues in his State of the Union address. Yesterday, the Vice National Security Advisor also said that the main issue between the two countries is in the economic field. How do you interpret the fact that 2 weeks before the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping's visit to the States, the United States has started to shift the attention from other issues
I'm afraid this question is not suitable for this panel. I appreciate the question. That would have been an interesting question for the last panel, but let me go to a different question. This panel is about TPP and about military strategy. So I appreciate your question. Thank you very much.
Might I ask a follow-up question?
Could you please give the mic back? Thank you. We'll take one last question. The gentleman in the middle here.
Thank you. Deng Huiyu with China Review News Agency. My question is for General Gregson. Last week, the Pacific Commander, Admiral Willard, said he was delighted to see the U.S.-China strategic dialogue keep going, but he was not satisfied with the U.S.-China military-to-military relationship because the tactical and practical levels exchanges have not been advanced. What do you think about this argument? And what obstacle need to be removed? How about the idea of inviting China to join, to participate in a joint military exercise in the Asia-Pacific region? Thank you.
Admiral Willard's comments about the most recent strategic and economic dialogue are consistent with what happened, in my opinion, at the previous strategic and economic dialogues, in that virtually every agency or function enjoys a very good relationship with their Chinese counterparts, but the discussions between the representatives of the U.S. Defense Department and the U.S. military and the PLA are always much, much more difficult. What needs to change? We've had some success with the military maritime consultative agreement. We've had less success with others. The United States is determined to continue to engage with the PLA when and where we can. And it's up to developments, I think, on the PLA side on whether we want to go forward with this.
It should be asked about a joint exercise. Any opinion on that?
I think we've tried joint exercises. I think we've gotten as far as search and rescue exercises. There may be others that we've done since then, but I'm not sure of that. So the principle is established that we're willing to participate in joint exercises.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate your patience, your interest in it. Look on the website in the next day or two for anything you missed.